Maybe it's a pity to speak. It's so sweet in here, and quiet and still. I don't think it was this still Sunday night in the opening in here, that first sitting. Some of you might have picked up the energy of leaving and the thoughts and spinning of that. But even so, I think probably all of you, some part of you, is more stable. And some part of you has some kind of well-being that you didn't have a week ago. Maybe it's not a conventional happiness or well-being, but maybe your mind is not any happier, but maybe your body is more content before it picks up all the stresses tomorrow. And maybe you're more confident, a little bit more confident, a lot confident. If you knew this was going to be a 10-minute sitting, yeah, I'm sure I can nail that. No problem. Thank you very much for this week and for your practice, and that we shared this together for this time. I think these the topics of the three characteristics are central topics in any human life. If they're not central topics in human life, then it might not quite be a human life. The people are somewhat disconnected from what's really happening here. I often prefer to talk about the path of practice that leads to maturation, as opposed to the kind of more definitive words like enlightenment or liberation. I certainly believe in experiences of profound release, freedom that can come. But I kind of suspect that it's wiser to not emphasize them too much, but to talk about something that's a little bit more gradual and a little bit more personal, and maybe something that kind of doesn't ever end. And that's a process of maturation. We can easily see how children mature as they grow up. But you know, turn 18 or 21, there's not like a prohibition for maturing anymore. People continue to grow and develop, mature. And I think there's maturity along this path and growth. And I think important ingredients for this maturity is to have a honest, full meeting, encounter with impermanence. Some people will encounter it more in a bigger way than others. Some of the people in tragedies. But we all are sharing this world of impermanence and change and inconstancy. And part of maturity is to really meet and encounter the suffering of life, the dukkha, the unsatisfactoriness. And I think a lot of people mature through their suffering. And if we avoid all suffering at all costs, I think we shortchange ourselves in the maturation process and the growth. And we mature also in this real deep encounter with ourselves. You know, the great from one perspective, one of the great tasks of life is to know oneself. And part of maturation is to get to know oneself, get to know how one works and operates and what makes one tick and one's beliefs and challenges. I've told this story a few times, but many years ago, happened to be at a meeting of, everyone there was a very senior Zen teacher in American Zen. And it was kind of an informal time for them to be together, it was more personal meeting for the day. So they were talking about personal things, and at some point the topic was to talk about what their challenges were, or what their practice was, and what they're practicing with. And they went around, and many of them told about the kind of ordinary challenges that people have. Some of them talked about having certain situations brought up fear and nervousness for them. You know, they've been practicing Zen for 40 years. And, you know, you're kind of like, what? After 40 years, they're still nervous? Shouldn't there be some, you know, proof that they've, you know, somehow become free and something, no more fear or something? But what inspired me was in front of their peers, other great Zen teachers, they were seemingly to me completely unself-conscious about talking about their foibles and their challenges. And it was like, they were like, yeah, this is how it is. In a very kind of open and relaxed way. Yeah, this is what I'm practicing with. Like, of course. And, you know, it was like, oh, you know, that ease, there was the ease and the relaxation and the transparency of how they were with their challenges that was inspiring for me. They knew themselves. They knew themselves well enough to know what their foibles were, their challenges were, and they knew themselves well enough to hold it lightly or to not be concerned about how they were seen by their peers or how they were judged or that they were supposed to be, you know, sterling examples of Zenishness, whatever that is. And and one of the things that attracted me to my own Zen teacher, Mel Weitzman, was is what I felt from the first time I met him, and was that he was so ordinary. I think probably one of the first times I met him, I was in a sitting group in Davis, and he came up to do a half day sitting in someone's living room. And I told you about how nervous I was. I chickened out on my first retreat, so some of you were a little nervous coming to talk to Matthew and I, maybe. Well, I was so nervous seeing the first time in that kind of practice discussion that I couldn't speak. And he said to me, "Gil, breathe deeply." So that was nice. Anyways, it was a half day, and then we had a potluck lunch or something. And this was 1976 or something. Explains a little bit what I'm about to say. And one of the hosts of the house, said, "You know, I can't find my cigarettes." And Mel said, "Oh, they're next to the bed upstairs on the little side table." And I was so impressed that he was mindful enough, attentive enough, he knew exactly where they were. It wasn't his, but he kind of like, oh, that was, I was, wow, that's an example of a really good, mindful Zen. But what was even better? They weren't there. He made a mistake. And that was also, that was even more inspiring to me. That kind of freed me. Like, you know, I had this projection and this thing, and then suddenly I was, a few minutes later, I was like freed of, oh, he can make mistakes too. That was great. So to know oneself. And how do we do this stuff? How do we do these things, this maturation? I think it helps to become stable, to have some capacity for inner stability, physical stability, to be able to sell, which is a very powerful thing to do because it also means we can hold our ground and take a stand. And there are times when we are expected or it's appropriate to take a stand, hold our ground, not give in, and to have a simple, relaxed stability and ability to be still is amazingly powerful at sometimes. It doesn't mean that you have to attack or blame or get angry. It doesn't mean you have to step away, but it means sometimes that people have to deal with you. You're not going, you're here. But to deal with ourselves, imagine taking a stand in being peaceful, a stand in being not caught in all the complications of greed, hate, delusion, ego, conceit. And to be able to do that, not because the mind doesn't do that, but because we know how to be still and stable and not be swept around by the winds of the mind. And to have a sense of well-being, contentment, settledness. Maybe the body becomes a resource, refuge for well-being, even when the mind has its challenges. And that sometimes we have confidence. And with those three, we can have those insights. We can address these basic existential issues of human life in a way that's maturing and helps us to grow and develop, become wiser. I appreciate very much that you're all here doing this. I don't think I underestimate. I probably underestimate. But I'd like to say, I was going to say, I don't think I underestimate how challenging it is to do this and how challenging it is to meet our lives and meet our human condition and how we are and all this. And I think of this as being a very important task, a task of a lifetime, to do this kind of work. And it doesn't end here at IRC, but it begins, you know, but it's part of this wonderful journey, the worthwhile journey. And the final words I'll say about this is that and then we'll take some questions and answers here in the hall, is somewhere down there, I think in the dishwashing area, there's a little poster that says something like, life is too important to take it seriously. And I love that combination. It's so important. But to take it seriously, I think what it means is to get heavy and grim and to be weighed down by it. It is important. It's so important that we want to be able to meet it with the best we have, to be mature and open, stable, and to be able to meet this world in a full way, not take it too seriously, because it's so important. So then I'll end kind of our theme of this retreat, the three insights into impermanence, suffering, and not-self, with the American version of this, which is, life will put you through changes. It hurts. And don't take it personally. Yeah. So we've done very few, very little, except maybe a little bit the beginning, first day. But if you want to ask any questions about the teachings or practice or anything to Matthew and I, we can take about 15 minutes or so and hear what's on your mind, your hearts. And if you could speak into the mics, I think John's going to pass it around. That would be helpful for everyone.
For someone who practices regularly a meditation around 40 minutes a day, how often would you recommend going on retreats, and what how the length of the retreats, like maybe 1 week a year, and then 3 month every like 5 years or something? How what would you recommend to progress the maturity in practice?
A great question, and I would like to hear what Matthew thinks.
No, you answer. I'll be the footnotes on that. Go ahead.
Really?
Yeah.
So much for being the senior teacher. It's a great question, and I don't really know how to answer it exactly, but this is what I will say, that for many years, in my first years of practice, it was kind of intuitive. So I would sit a retreat, like 7 day retreat, and it's the last thing I wanted to do again for, you know, ever at the end. Again, you know, wouldn't, you know, was no way. It was a Zen retreat, so a little different, you know, mostly I pain retreats. But it was also great. And then I would, and then it would take me about, after about 4 or 5 months, I was kept sitting every day. I started getting this feeling inside, oh, it's time. I got this draw, this yearning, or this momentum I could feel inside, oh, it's time to go sit again. So then about 6 months after the first one, I would do a second one. So, but every 6 months is when that feeling came, this rhythm, and that worked really well for me. And then as I practiced, then at some point there became this yearning or desire, this momentum to sit longer and to kind of go, to kind of really delve into that world that opens up on retreat. So then I started sitting longer and longer and longer retreats. And so I was just following this instinct or this intuition. So that's kind of, you know, was what I know. More as a kind of general policy, which I don't know how, you know, seriously it should be followed, but I think if you want one, I think once a year is good. Just going to have a retreat once a year. We learn something about ourselves and learn something about our practice, and I think of retreats as being truth tellers. Kind of find out what's really going on sometimes. We sometimes don't notice and know about ourselves unless we go on retreat. And so I think once a year is someone who's serious about this. So as a policy, until you get that yearning. So another footnote.
Well, insofar as one's life is set up so that if there's an interest in sitting longer retreats, a couple weeks or months, that's a precious opportunity. Like when there's actually intention to do that and conditions are conducive, that's good to take advantage of that. And as a general kind of principle, I would. Yeah, I think that intuitive piece feels right, and But at home, for home practice, I would sit a little more than you want to, you know? just a little. Not much more, but a little bit more. And maybe the same for retreat. But hopefully it actually starts to feel like, you know, there's a kind of, yeah, change that happens in practice at some point where it's like there's just less energy to keep it going. It's just a sense of no going back and a sense of, to not practice would be to, like, to abandon one's own heart, you know? It's just like, it just feels easier to keep going.
Is it allowable to have a footnote to the footnote? Or
yeah. Yeah. Don't you dare contradict me publicly, Gil.
Footnote is a toe note. Sometimes when I've been on long retreats or been a teacher for long retreats, I've been so enthusiastic about the month-long retreats that I've had this thought that, like in Islam, you're supposed to go to Mecca once a lifetime, that for Vipassana practitioners, at least once a lifetime, you should sit a month-long retreat. I've had that thought. It's our Mecca.
So first I want to say thank you for the retreat. Thank all of you. I think we're all a little reluctant to speak right now. Which kind of brings up a question of mine. Sometimes when I'm still at home, it puts people off. It comes across as aloof and disconnected, and I don't know how to resolve that. I'm very happy to be quiet, but I don't know how to take that with me in a practical way.
This is not a proud story. I'm in a park, and I see this. I think it was like, I don't know, maybe an eight-year-old kid, girl with her dad, you know, and for whatever reason, my heart was just like super open, you know. I don't know if I was formally practicing or something, but I just see this kid and like the heart just wide open. And I just naturally fell into, you know, a like very kind of expansive metta state. And she's a stranger, but just seeing her face was just like, oh, I wanted everything good for her, and I would have done anything in that moment, you know, that she be happy. And I just kind of kept gazing at her, and then she caught my eye, and she started crying hysterically. I was creeping her out with my expansive metta, you know. I really was. It was hysterical. Like it was hysterical crying, and she alerted her father, and it was just like, oh, no more metta, no more. the moral of that beautiful story is just around, like, you know, like actually attunement, like all of our peace or love or whatever, like it really has to be attuned and appropriate to the situation. And so we kind of like use our internal flexibility to modulate ourselves a bit to meet the needs of the social situation. And so sometimes we actually, you know, we are expressing different facets of our heart. And I think, you know, the practice can be disruptive in the sense that it often does, it changes some of our social relationships, and there are people that we'll spend more or less time with, you know, over the course of practice. And but it never should lead to actual sense of disconnection, you know, like the heartfelt sense of disconnection or connection, because even though we may choose, like, oh, these people just don't have my values, or they just can't understand my heart, like there's something very alienating about not the particularities of one's heart, one's commitment, one's love not being seen. That's alienating. And so that means that we may not spend our time with people in the same way, but the actual sense of connection and the sense of solidarity with, you know, most everyone is nurtured by the practice. And the just seeing oneself in all other beings, like it just supports some sense of connection, even if we have different values or, you know, life plans or whatever. Yeah. Does that speak to it?
A little. Thank you.
Okay, B minus, fine. Yeah, so what else? And Gil can answer the rest.
Has anybody come across this in their practice?
I've had that.
I gave up practice once because I couldn't manage that divide. I was living with some people, and I was meditating every morning, and I came to breakfast, and I was just, you know, I felt like I'm either going to lose my friends or I have to leave or something. So I stopped meditating so that I could be connected to them, because I didn't have the skills then to know how to navigate, how to bridge these two worlds. And so it took a while to learn how to stay connected and, you know, and kind of pull out of this state of calm that I had and be engaged with people. There's two reasons I can think of why people feel that one is a meditator might be aloof. Some people are simply frightened by the fact that they're meditating because they're afraid they're going to change too much, or they feel they're about to become a monastic, or just you know, it's so different from what they're familiar with, different paradigm almost, that it just seems like this is going to be disruptive. And so, and coming on retreat can be even worse for some people. And so I think that in that situation, I think if it's people you love and care for, is to reassure them and show them through your actions that you're not leaving them, that you're still committed and still involved and interested in them. So you can show them. And the other reason for feeling this is that, like coming out of meditation, when it's calm and peaceful in a way that maybe isn't comfortable for people, and the currency of conversation is gossip, or the currency is, you know, complaining. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, you're not doing that, so it's a little awkward. And so two things. One is to, I think it's good not to be hold on too much to the state one gets, you know, like too much, you know, so that you're not connecting, you're not attuned. You can use it to be attuned, but to don't use it, in, you know, don't hold back because of it. And then, you know, be interested in them. be curious, be, you know, kind of lean to those, go towards them and find out what's going on. And maybe you can find a way to be with them that is harmonious with your new values, but to make them feel like you're interested and connected. But it takes being some proactive.
Thank you.
So, okay. So maybe we should move on to the next step. So in a few minutes, we'll have the managers. I guess Kirsten will make the announcements, closing announcements you need for tonight. And there's more announcements tomorrow. So there's different things you'll learn as we go along here. But one of the things I like to do, now that you've had the experience of IRC and been here, is to kind of be a little bit more articulate about IRC, with the hope that you understand, and by understanding maybe take it in deeply, that part of what IRC is a place to practice, but it's also the practice place. It's kind of like the medium is the message, kind of, or the practice environment, the culture, the way we do things, is part of what supports practice and nourishes practice and inspires practice and points to a way that the practice can be lived in the world. And so, you know, it's so unusual what we do here that maybe some people don't believe it, or they don't understand it, or it's cause they don't, you know, they don't stop to take it into account. So I think you understand that we don't charge for anything here, and that is unusual, to come and stay for 7 days someplace and be fed and have a single room, and sometimes I'm a little embarrassed how this place is. But this place is the way it is because of causes and conditions. And a big part of that is that there are a tremendous amount of peoples whose generosity make it possible for this place to be here. Everything here is because of people's generosity. People who made donations, tremendous amount of people who donated their time and effort and creativity to kind of do this. And just about almost everything you see and touch, pretty much everything, especially here on the second floor, little bits left over down below from the original owners, but almost everything, I can confidently say someone thought about with love. Someone thought about in a beautiful, heartfelt, generous way, to how would this work best for people coming, thinking about the retreat and retreatants and coming, and how to take care of people and how to do it. And so what we have here is a field of generosity, a field of goodwill, a field of goodness, a field of gratitude. A lot of what inspires a lot of people has been their gratitude to kind of make this possible for everyone to be here in practice. And we have this idea that the Dharma in our hearts, the Dharma practice, is best nourished and supported in that kind of field. And it's kind of a field that's all voluntary. It's all voluntary. And we have this idea that that's kind of the best, where the best comes out of us. If it's obligatory, or if it's kind of usual idea of an exchange or monetary exchange or payment, it's fine. There's wisdom to that. I don't want to denigrate that way of doing things, but it creates a different condition, a different way it feeds us and nourishes us. And I think this is really optimal for the Dharma practice. And so not only are you the recipient of that, by being in this field, but you're also been the creator of it. All of you have had jobs, all of you have come here and offered yourself and your practice and everything. And so we're kind of like living the embodiment of these values, and even if you don't feel like you have those values inside of you, you've been faking it. I mean, I don't know if that's the right word, but you know, you've been enacting it, you know, or supporting it. And so my hope is that not only will you kind of appreciate this and that it supported you, but that by understanding this, that maybe when you leave here, you'll go out into the world and bring these values and this approach, this kind of way, into the world around us. The world around us, this world that we live in, needs a lot more goodwill, needs a lot more generosity, a lot more goodness, a lot more gratitude. And it's a beautiful thing to kind of feel it and touch it, and then to feel inspired by it, and then kind of bring it out and into the world. And if you do that, because there's about 44 of you, then for Matthew and I, it's a pyramid scheme for joy. Pretty good, and it's legal too. You want to use this or this?
I'll use that, thank you. It's nice to see you all from up here. Can you hear me okay? Okay, I have some closing announcements, and then I'm also going to ask for rides home for a couple of people. As we begin the gradual transition of returning to our daily lives, we want to do so in a mindful, unhurried manner. In general, you can trust the schedule. All will go smoothly. Tomorrow, the morning will begin the same way, including Sangha service. Those who have morning work meditations after breakfast, please do them as usual. In the morning, we have two cleaning periods, one for your room and one for the center. There will be time scheduled tomorrow to pack and clean your room, but if you have time after breakfast, feel free to start. To clean your room, please follow the green instruction sheet in your room. It tells you what to do and where all the cleaning supplies are located. Are there any questions about what I've asked so far? Okay. The donation envelopes can be found on top of the Donna box between the office and meeting room one in the community hall. That's downstairs. You can place a check, cash, or credit card in them and direct your donation to the teachers, the center, or both. Instructions are on the envelope. Then you can drop them in the slot. Your donations are very much appreciated. If you need to print a boarding pass, please leave a note for us managers on the board and check for a response. And now on to rides. So there are a couple of people that need to go to the San Jose airport, and one person needs to depart at 4 p.m., so I'm thinking probably they need to get there by 2 or 2:30. Is there anyone who can take two people to the airport? Okay. Thank you. Jason and Chen Min, would you like to join the shuttle? Okay. So we'll get. I think we should give your shuttle service a call so we can connect with you and get that done. Thank you. And then there's one request to go. I think the preference is to go to Salinas. Is that right?
Either Santa Cruz or Marina.
Oh, okay. Santa Cruz or the Marina. Can anyone give a ride to Santa Cruz or the Marina? Great. Thank you. Thank you. Okay, that's all the rites. Please turn in your IRC sheets and towels as early as possible tomorrow, even before the first sit. Also, please turn in your bath mat. Do not turn in your blanket or pillow protector. Laundry baskets will be placed on each floor. Are there any questions? I'm going to place laundry baskets on each floor. So there'll be instructions on where to place them.
I think it's possible, but it might be a little bit, I'm not so sure how that works. And I think it's a little awkward for the whole volunteer bookkeeping system. What might work better is to take the envelope home with you and just mail an envelope. Fill it out and then mail it back. I think that works better. Does that any?
Are these questions just about things you've already said? Or are you going to say more now? Because my question is different. Why don't I just ask it? just for the comfort of rules, when does the noble silence officially end? Or when does our retreat end?
Okay, so
I'm going to turn that to the senior teacher.
For those of you who might be new to this whole process at IRC, we've given some thought to how the closing unfolds, the whole the ending ends, and how you prepare to leave. Apparently, there's a story is told that 40 years ago when Jack Kornfield and Joseph Goldstein and Sharon Salzberg first doing the retreats, they would do these long retreats, and then they just ring the bell at the end, just like in the last sitting, and okay, go home. And then they got a phone call from the local grocery store saying there's someone walking around the grocery store in her pajamas. And it was a little unusual for that part of rural Massachusetts. And so they realized that they couldn't just kind of ring the bell and, you know, silence on, ding, go home. So they started what's called integration, you know, to make it gradual. And there's also stories of people who weren't properly integrated and driving back on the freeway and that the police pulls them over. I don't know if this is true or apocryphal, but this is told, the story, that it pulls them over and the police officer says, "Do you realize how fast you're driving?" And, you know, was I going 75? You were going 35 in the freeway. So it can be kind of a bit of a shock to kind of just ring the bell and, you know, start talk. So we start gradually, and Matthew made the announcement that Dharma talk about this change in schedule today. And for some of you, maybe that was the beginning. Some of you already began integrating or thinking about leaving already, but that was kind of a gentle beginning, we hope, and to start. And then to here, energetically, it's different than a Dharma talk, and we're talking and answering questions in here, and the energy is up a little bit. And that's part of, you know, it's partly to take care of things and partly to do this process. And now we'll go back into silence. And this gives us a chance to check in and find out what's going on and practice with whatever's happening. And there's a long history in Buddhism that some of the really important areas of wisdom, maybe maturation, comes not from going down deeper and deeper into practice, but going however deep we go, coming up and out. There's a time to see and understand in a way that's very, very helpful. So some people, as soon as they start thinking more actively, getting ready to leave, they brush off the practice, oh, it doesn't count anymore. But actually it might count more. So we have this evening to be silent. Tomorrow morning will be silent. And then it's silent until about 11:15, when we have the closing circle downstairs at the same place where we had the opening circle on Sunday. And then we'll do kind of a comparable thing that we did the opening circle. And after that, that's the official breaking of silence. You know, then you can stand around and chat, and there's snacks and things like that. Is that what you wanted to hear?
Yes, sir.
Yes.
Somebody's going to ask it. Thank you, Chris, for developing all the wonderful recipes. Where can we find them?
Well, as a group effort, first of all, let's talk about it after the end.
Yeah. It's a good thing to ask at the end. I'm sure it's there's other people ask, so there'll be an answer. But I think at the end, and it's a good time for that conversation. Take good care of yourself and take good care of your community that we've had these days here. Thank you.